Our last talk comes from Mark Hood and Brad McCoy, capturing and disseminating the knowledge of audio preservation experts. Mark Hood is Associate Professor of Music and Recording Arts at Indiana University Jacobs School of Music. From 2008 to 2010, he was a Research Associate and Chief Engineer of the Sound Directions Project at the IU Archives of Traditional Music and served on the Media Preservation Task Force that researched and developed plans for IU's Media Preservation and Development Initiative, which is beginning full operations this spring. He's enjoyed a 40-plus year career as an audio engineer and producer, and is the founder and managing partner of Echo Park Studios in Bloomington, Indiana. He currently serves as co-chair of the ARSC Technical Committee. Brad McCoy serves as a senior engineer for the Library of Congress Audio Preservation Lab. He's been a member of ARSC for a long time and is active in the technical committee. He is also active in the Audio Engineering Society, where he serves on technical standards and historical committees and has given numerous presentations at the annual conventions. He is a voting member of the Recording Academy and is on the advisory council for the Producers and Engineers Wing. Finally, he is on the Technical Task Force for the National Recording Preservation Board. Everyone, Mark and Brad.
Thank you. We've been talking a long time about capturing expert engineer knowledge. I recall in the ARS Technical Committee at least 10, maybe 15 years ago, talking about how are we going to capture the knowledge of engineers before they're gone. Well, we finally have gotten to the point where we've done it, and soon some of those videos are going to be available on websites so that all of you can see them. What really has made that happen now? And I need to point directly to the impetus of the National Recording Preservation Plan. Now, many of you are very familiar with the Recording Preservation Plan. It was highlighted very much at the Kansas City Conference, and there were certainly programs about it last year in Chapel Hill. But some of you don't know about the plan. So I'm going to give just a real brief background into the Preservation Plan, and then Mark is going to talk a little bit about how the ARS Technical Committee got involved and play a little bit of some footage that he captured with Richard Hess about playing tape, analog tape. And then I'm going to play some videos that we captured at the Library of Congress about cylinders with David Giovannoni. Okay. So the plan has been discussed, presented many conferences. It was funny, I was talking, just looking through my notes here, at the AES convention in 2013, there were six programs dedicated to the preservation plan. But what exactly is the plan? Where is the genesis? The plan came from the National Recording Preservation Act of 2000, which is an act of Congress. Congress mandated that the blueprint for saving America's recorded sound heritage for future generations asked to us to give some recommendations for public and private sector infrastructure, et cetera, and created, importantly, the Preservation Board, some of the members of which are here, and the leaders, and the Recorded Sound Registry, and the fundraising foundation part. So here it is, Public Law 106474. So you can see it's a mandate that's very important from Congress. The board itself is made up of representatives from 17 organizations, including ARSC, including AES, and a number of others. There are five at-large members. They have been told that they need to give the selection criteria for the registry, where they work with the librarian on that. The National Recording Preservation Study, which came out in 2010, and the Preservation Plan from 2012. So what was the study? This is a copy of it. I didn't bring copies of this, but actually I do have copies of the plan, which are not available right now, but I'll put out after this program and be in the lobby if those of you that may not have it. I brought a box of about 50 of them, so hopefully you all can get one if you need it. The study, though, as you can see, was done in or published in August of 2010, and some of the prime players are here. I think I saw Rob Bamberger walk in and a few others. There's Rob. Thank you. Assess the current state of recorded sound archiving, preservation, and restoration. Establish clear standards. Review current laws and restrictions. These are all ongoing things. And it's, by the way, available free if you want to look at it online at clir.org. And that's also true with the plan. So here is a quick look at, actually that's, yeah, that's kind of a fuzzy copy of what the plan looks like. I mean the study. The plan came out in December of 2012. And you can see we've moved on from the study to the plan, provide a blueprint to implement a comprehensive national sound recording preservation program with emphasis on increasing accessibility of sound recordings for educational purposes and a lot of coordination between public and private stakeholders. So there's just another little look at that, again, December of 2012. So how did this piece of capturing expert engineer knowledge come about? It's directly related to recommendation 1.8 in the plan. And by the way, there are a number of other programs at this conference related to the plan. Tomorrow, Saturday actually, Chris Lesinick and Mike Casey are going to be talking. Actually, I think Chris isn't here. So Mike is going to be presenting about that. And there's a few others that will be making reference. Certainly, the main one will be Sam Berlowski's talk Saturday afternoon. So make sure you come for that as well. Recommendation 1.8 specifically says to research, collect, document, and preserve information on legacy recording practices and technologies. Initiate a program to videotape engineers, senior audio engineers. I will mention a few things later about the ones from the Library of Congress, and I want to make sure that you get the website. So I'm going to bring this back up later, but there is the URL of the National Recording Preservation Board, and specifically the site in the plan where the video tutorials will appear. We were kind of hoping to have them done this week. It didn't quite work out, but I think they're going to be up pretty soon. So I'll bring that slide again back up later, but basically if you would Google recording board preservation plan tools and resources or video tutorials, you'll eventually get there. So don't worry about copying that down. It'll come back to you in a few minutes. So Mark, at this point, is going to talk a little bit about how the technical committee of ARS got involved and also present some of the Richard Hess video.
Good afternoon. Thanks for coming. And if we do hear another fat lady sing, it doesn't mean I'm done. You know, we're still going to keep going. So, okay. In late 2012, in response to the plan, and with the help of the Library of Congress and the NFCB, the technical committee of ARS wrote a proposal to the NFCB and the library for a grant to develop a pilot project video. As Brad mentioned, for many years, ARS members had really expressed a lot of concerns that much of the in-depth expertise that is represented by so many members of this organization might eventually be lost. You put it more morbidly, but we're going to lose them sometime. And ARSC is anxious to preserve this knowledge from these sources into the future via video interviews and tutorials with the various experts that exist in our membership. So the proposal was written and submitted to NFCB and approved by the Library of Congress. So with this grant, planning began, and the technical committee decided to focus for its original pilot project for trying to prove how this would work and explore what we want to do in the future based on the results. We decided to focus on quarter-inch magnetic tape as our starting point. Partially because some of the reasons would be that lots of archives have lots of this format to deal with, both small archives and large archives. And relatively speaking, it's a somewhat easy topic to address in terms of best practices for quarter-inch tape. We steered away from disc playback for possible obvious reasons because of the multitude of formats and the histories and a lot of different techniques that are involved in disc playback that seemed too ambitious for our first pilot project. So we chose quarter-inch tape. Our planning process was to develop a script outline at first, so we felt that an instructional video or a tutorial that addressed quarter-inch tape playback had to contain at least these elements. Some sort of initial assessment, especially including health risks for tapes that are heavily contaminated with mold or things that are growing that we don't know what they are, setting those aside. And then analysis of the composition of the tape, how it's been put together, which gives you some idea of its structure. And as a result, it gives you some idea of the possible problems with each format of tape, so acetate, polyester, other possibilities, and what problems you should be looking for as an audio archivist. Then to become familiar with track formats, how the magnetic structure is actually divided into geographic channels invisibly, but yet you have to decipher that. Important things like why you should clean your machine, and how to clean your machine, and with what to clean your machine. Threading the machine, since every machine is different, and there's nothing more exciting than walking into the studio and seeing the tape completely misthreaded on the archiving deck. So that seemed important to emphasize. Spooling, library wind, how to repair splices and inspect for damage, and adding leader if you need to. Azimuth adjustment once it's on the machine. And then how to wind up with your tape in the correct condition, in a condition that you can store it with confidence for the future. Obviously, some of these topics are more involved than others. So cleaning the machine shouldn't be a 45-minute video, we felt. That should be so much shorter. But yet, tape composition and related problems, soft binder syndrome and various things deserves more attention. We certainly decided not to address all possible remediations for obscure problems. For example, we don't recommend various techniques to deal with mold other than to be aware of it. Mold is a dangerous substance, so we didn't feel we were qualified to publish an OSHA-approved version of how to deal with mold. Lots of vendors do it. We didn't feel ARSC should be in a position of advocating something that is a health risk, potential health risk. And there are certainly some obscure formats. I have not seen a six-track data logger. That's very exciting for you, not for me. But I love all of these rare formats. It's really fun. And obviously, spending a weekend with Richard Hess is a great way to get familiar with obscure formats that you never realized existed. So we purposely excluded some of the more obscure topics and formats to try and develop something that is helpful to small archives and people just getting started in this, but at the same time, it's not just a vanilla, no-risk stuff, because we are talking to experts who have years of opinions embedded in their technique. So then our action plan was to develop a shooting script. In this case, since we couldn't get Clint Eastwood to do it, we had to not specify specific lines that they were to speak, but we actually came up with topics we wanted to cover in the correct order and make sure we had them covered. Identify and make a contract with a host expert. In this case, we chose Richard Hess, who has a studio in Ontario and a preservation business. And we chose Richard because he's an acknowledged expert in the field, certainly. He's a meticulous note taker. He spends a lot of his life, it seems, adding to his website, and every time he discovers a new problem or develops a new approach to solving a problem, he documents it very thoroughly in very clear language. And he has a very impressive website with a body of knowledge that he shares freely. So that made an impression on us as well. And we picked him too because he agreed to do it. That was important to us, that we have a willing volunteer. So we made arrangements to travel to his studio in Aurora, Ontario, which is 20 or so miles north of Toronto. So the next part of our action plan was get there, shoot on location, spend some time editing, some time being a nebulous quantity that we'll talk about. And at that point, when we felt we had a product that we were close to making public, we felt that it was important to vet it with the entire technical committee. These are topics that have different points of view, and we wanted to be sure of what we were putting forward. So that's part of the process. And at that point, publishing by accessibility via the internet Our proposal contained the plan to publish it on the ARSC website. We're talking with the Education and Training Committee and also the NRPB, which is publishing the cylinder video on its website. We're talking to them about how to best coordinate the availability of these videos to the intended target audiences. So I traveled to Richard's studio slash office slash basement in Aurora in July of 2013 to do the shoot. There are always some surprises. I'm sure if I spent my life in the film business, I'd realize you should do more of a location scouting job before you show up. There were some problems with this. It took about 3 hours of rearranging furniture to create just this much space in his office so that we could do the shoot. I hired a lighting videographer named Walter Corbett, who was recommended to me. So he brought the video equipment and the sound recording equipment, as well as a full lighting kit, so that we could set up in Richard's basement. This is another shot pretty much from the same perspective as the last slide. And just in case you're thinking, oh, well, that's pretty wide to the left there, that's actually a mirror on the left wall that's reflecting the bookcase on the right wall, which is 6 feet away from the left wall. So it was pretty tight. Richard spent a lot of time sitting there while we lit him and arranged a backdrop, so it was pretty to look at. And it was hard work. Even though they're LED lights, Richard got tired and was sweating, and his one comment to me after we were done, after two very long days of shooting, he said, I think it would be fair to warn the next host how much work this is. I think he wasn't expecting that it would really take 2 10-hour days of shooting plus many hours of rearranging furniture to get this done. And we used this his office space here too also as a setting for the whiteboard drawings that we used to illustrate some of the topics that he talks about. And then when we were done with the headshots and the whiteboard stuff, we moved into his not very large studio. So Wally is setting up his camera on a teeny tiny dolly and the lighting, and I think I am standing on Richard's desk to take this shot, and we had to take all of that stuff back out to really shoot in there because with all those extra decks, we couldn't even get the rest of the cameras in. It's very tiny. So following this outline that we developed for our script idea, we basically shot all the footage we felt we needed to cover these topics, and we have completed editing the major modules, one which is not that major, but 2 and 3, the tape composition and related problems, and the tape formats modules are edited. They're roughly 22 minutes and 11 minutes respectively. The other modules will be significantly shorter. By and large, the azimuth module might be 10 minutes by the time we get through all the stuff we did. So that's what we have at the moment. For you today, I have prepared an excerpted version of module number 3, the track formats. So I will play that for you now. It's about 7.5 minutes, and it gives you an idea of how we approached it and how the video looks, and we'll go from there, except we should probably start at the beginning. All right, so view. And with audio, please.
Track format is very important. Matching the head to the track format is crucial for a quality transfer. The common formats that you will be asked to transfer are full track mono, DIN stereo, NAB stereo, and a variety of combinations of usage of 4 tracks on quarter inch tape. We are now turning our perspective to the backside of the tape, actually, because this is how it's the easiest to think of it. The dotted line is the head gap. And we're looking through the backside of the tape. This is the quarter-inch side of quarter-inch tape. And we're going to explore some of the track formats that you will find. So if we look here, the first thing we have is the tape is a quarter of an inch out to out. It never exceeds it. It's set up so the tolerance is actually on the minus side, so it's like 246 to 250. So the first way we populated this was a full track head. So this was the entire width of the tape was used for the audio. Okay, well, that's really, really, really useful for mono. But in the, well, in the late, mid-40s, the Germans started were experimenting with stereo, and in the very early 50s, the Americans were experimenting with stereo. So several track formats came out. The Germans used a very wide format with the guard band here, 0.75 millimeters. While the Americans roughly, and these are rough numbers, made tracks that had were roughly two millimeter guard band, 2 millimeter track. So much wider guard band, but narrower track, so the signal-to-noise ratio wasn't as good. But later on, this space became useful for time code, to synchronize the tape to video, for example. So these are pretty much the professional formats, full, DIN, and NAB stereo. Consumers came along and tape was expensive. So in the very late 50s, quarter track stereo came along. The one further thing that I'm not even going to attempt to draw is this got divided again for the 8-track cartridge, and there were 8 21 mil tracks with associated guard bands. In digitizing old audio tapes, one of the huge challenges we have is determining what the track format is on the tape. The magnetism itself is invisible to the naked eye. And it's relatively weak forces, or two, compared to the giant horseshoe magnet you might have. So you can have a magnetic viewer that lets you look directly at the magnetism on the tracks. Okay, this is a Sigma from Japan. The MV95 is useful, but has some issues as far as speed of response, but it's very sensitive. So in order to do that, what you do is you have a tape on the machine, you pull a loop off, lay it down. This works really well on a flat machine where gravity is your friend, and lay the magnetic viewer on top of the tape. We've talked many times about matching the tape head to the tape format. This is where we figure out how we're actually going to physically accomplish that. There are many ways of doing it. One way, which I don't recommend, is you have a machine for every format. And the reason that doesn't work is that the machines all require maintenance, they all require spare parts, and it's unlikely you're going to find all the same model machine in all the formats you want. So one of the things we do is we have replaceable head blocks on a machine. Now, this is for the Sony APR, and it fits, this whole assembly removes. And It allows us to change on the machine what head we are using on a given base machine. Now, this particular block is arranged with two different playheads rather than the record head. And one of the reasons we did that was to conserve head assemblies for infrequently used heads, and we put a switch in that selected one or the other. This enables us to have two formats in one head assembly. So a wide variety of play heads to match the wide variety of tape formats we get in. And this enables us to do that critical matching that optimizes crosstalk between tracks and optimizes signal-to-noise ratio.
So obviously, there aren't many beauty shots available in audio preservation, so panning between heads and decks was about the best we could do for beauty shots. But right, so let's get back to PowerPoint. So that's obviously a bit chopped up for time's sake, so that we don't have to sit through all the explanations, but it gives you an idea of the approach we're taking. Okay, sorry, I was supposed to play from current. Get to live through this again. Okay. So to continue our work plan, then what we're trying to do with these videos is we've achieved 1 through 3, part of 4, and in the next couple of weeks we will make it available to members of the technical committee to vet the content and discuss how to make sure we've covered the topic correctly and also avoided recommending a particular workflow that not everybody agrees upon. So we want to make sure that the information that we're putting forward is either best practices as agreed to by ARSC and other international standards, or it's clearly someone's opinion. So we're going to make sure that that's clear in the videos. And then we will make it accessible. But then to continue with the plan that we submitted to the NRPB and the Library of Congress, we want to evaluate feedback from users at that point and evaluate not only their reaction to this particular video or set of videos, depending on how we break it up into chapters and modules, but amongst the TC and ARSC in general, I would think, especially the Education and Training Committee, evaluate this approach. Is this how we want to disseminate expert information? What do we want to tackle next? What are our future plans? But to make sure that we're coordinating it with NRPB and efforts within LC, to make sure that we're not duplicating things. The manual has just come out that you'll hear about. We want to make sure all these things are part of one team. We've reached the point where three or four different groups have been working on different things, and now we all have stuff, and now we want to make sure that stuff is coordinated and plan some more exciting future projects. While we were in Toronto and set up and had Richard locked in the building and couldn't leave, We shot an awful lot of footage, which is part of why editing has taken so long. But we actually have enough material to cover probably cassette playback techniques as well as another chapter with modules or something like that. Certainly, it's hard not to ask Richard to talk about unusual formats because he is an expert in unusual formats. So in particular, because he has some background in broadcasting as well, he's very familiar with the various broadcast cartridges and the track formats that were used for those, and he's developed some workflows that allow him to digitize those cartridges without using the original hardware by broadcasters, which is really not archival quality hardware. So that's interesting stuff. He also has a lot of instrumentation and telemetry tapes and data tape, not only experience and stock of tapes, but he owns a huge stock of crazy recorders that nobody's ever seen. We have footage of him holding up the Mount St. Helens seismic event tape that he digitized for the Geological Service, and they didn't want the tape back, so he kept it as a souvenir. I'm not sure how many small archives are going to have to deal with those, but it is an interesting topic, and we have video of it and Richard explaining of it. This should be part of the expertise that we capture from our experts as well, not just the basics. He has some unusual techniques, both hardware and workflow. So he has an elevator head, which is a four-track four-track head, I believe, that he can elevate anywhere without changing azimuth or zenith. He can change the elevation of the track so he can kind of scout through different tracks on quarter-inch tape and see what's playing back on which small head and decipher what the track format is from that and use it for various kind of esoteric playback purposes. And then, of course, for his solution for squealing tapes, one of them that he tries, besides lubrication and other topics that we discuss in other modules, is his refrigerated playback of putting the tape machine in a large refrigerator and reducing the temperature of the tape in the medium and eliminating the squealing, in some cases, with that. So we taped lots of discussion of all of that stuff. It doesn't belong in an elementary primer on tape playback, but it's valuable things that we captured. And then he does quite a long discussion of the broader history and taxonomy of magnetic tape recording and how it developed. Again, it seemed too, seemed too much for the elementary stuff. And then to get warmed up, I wanted to know Richard's personal history. How did he get in this field? What his technical background was? So we have quite a long personal history that we could flesh out as also part of our oral history of our members and our experts that could be part of the Ars Library as well. So that's where we stand. We hope to finish this up soon and get working on the next ones. And we could not have done it without all of these people and more, but certainly the NRPB, Library of Congress, Sam Brolowski, Bill Klinger, who acted as formal informer, track coach and liaison, Marcos, my co-chair on the technical committee that helped me write the proposal and keeps me in line, and Brad, who's very excited and active with these video projects to inspire us on. And obviously Richard for his great patience and his ongoing willingness to share his expertise to a great extent. Maybe we can get him to Bloomington. I've already started to get him to come to Bloomington. So thank you. And now I will turn it over to Brad. But let me cue you up. Thank you. Oh, I hate it when it jumps forward.
So what am I going to do to start? Just click on the...
Yeah, okay. The space bar might do it.
Thanks are always incomplete, but two people to definitely mention about the plan. Brenda Nelson Strauss is sitting here. We can't forget her and Jean Deanna, my boss, who I'm shamelessly promoting, but Jean's role is critical as well. Okay, so what about cylinders? Very different proposal, very different idea than quarter-inch analog tape. How did this get chosen? Basically, we had an expert training with David Giovannoni and Ward Marston, who came to the Library of Congress and trained our engineers on many things about cylinders and amazing amount of information in a couple of days. And specifically showed us how to use the Archaea phone that we have to transfer cylinders. We found, as Mark did, with a lot of video, it's sometimes hard to edit training videos and kind of unscripted videos into something that's easy to use on a website. So what you're going to see here is not from that specific training, but David very generously offered to come back and do something a little more formal where he gave a background into cylinders and he talked about training and he talked about using the Archaea phone, as you'll see in a minute. So unfortunately, Ward does not appear in this video, but Ward was very active in our initial training. And I should point out that the Library of Congress videos that we've been working on are a little bit different from what Mark has been talking about through the technical committee. They will appear soon. We were hoping to have them ready by the conference, but I've been assured, and they are ready to go. They just, you know, need to have a couple of clearances made, and they will be on the library's website very soon. And there's several other videos coming. We've already completed a video on room design, and we've completed one on workflow with two of the engineers, two of my colleagues who are here in the room, one with Pat Smetanik, who's in the back, and another with Rob Friedrich, who's here in the third row. So there will be more coming from the library as well. I guess all that said, I think it's probably best to just go ahead. There are three videos that will go on the library's website One of them is 15 minutes and 31 seconds, minutes 15:31, and that's on cylinder history. One on cylinder handling, that's about 8 minutes and 54 seconds. And then one specifically on our using the Archaeophone for cylinder transfer, that's about 15. That's about 40 minutes total. It's a lot of watching. Obviously, I can't show you 40 minutes, so I've edited this down to about an 8-minute piece. And there's a lot of editing that some of it's a little bit abrupt because, you know, we're taking excerpted pieces, but hopefully it'll still work for you. So let's go on with that. Yeah.
Can we take questions and then maybe show it because we're running short on time?
We got to show this first. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Dave Givinoni. I'm here in the beautiful studios of the Library of Congress's National Audiovisual Conservation Center at the Packard Campus in Culpeper, Virginia. And today we're going to talk a little bit about cylinder audio recordings. Thomas Edison invented the wax cylinder recording in 1888. The phonograph was invented in 1877, but the wax cylinder recording is an invention from 1888. They were made from 1888 until 1929. And they were actually made even longer than that for special purposes, well into the 1950s. The earliest cylinders, as we know them today, were made out of a wax-like material. This is an example of a wax cylinder. You would find this being made from the late 1880s, maybe 1890, until about 1901 or 2. These would come with music commercially recorded on them, or some sort of content. It could be a talk, a funny story, not just music. Around 1902, Edison started working in what we call a black wax. That looks like this. It's not really a wax at all. It's what's called a metallic soap compound. But these were recorded, these were actually molded. They were mass produced. So once a cylinder was cut and they had a studio performance was made and they had a master of that cylinder, they could then duplicate the cylinder as many copies as they wanted starting in around 1902 or 1903. Edison did not have the ability because of patent restrictions, to mold in anything other than wax until 1912. At that point, he introduced the blue amberol cylinder. You see that this cylinder is blue. It's a hard celluloid material. If I did that on the wax cylinder, it would leave fingernail marks all over it, so don't try that at home, kids. But the blue amberol cylinder was meant to be very sturdy, almost indestructible. In fact, the other companies' cylinders, Columbia and other companies who were still making cylinders at the time, did have a brand name called Indestructible. That's how tough these celluloid cylinders were compared to the wax and metallic soap before them. The blue amberol was in commercial production until 1929, at which time Edison shut down his entire phonograph and radio division. This is what's called a standard cylinder. It's about 4 inches long, a little over 2 inches in diameter. That was pretty much the standard size that Edison invented in 1888, and it remained the standard size through 1929. Let me talk just a little bit about storage of cylinders. You want to keep them in a cool, dry place. That's all you need to know. If you don't have a cool, dry place, make sure you have a dry, cool place. This cool-looking box is a relatively new invention. It was designed by Bill Klinger for the Association of Recorded Sound Collections and the Library of Congress, specifically to store cylinders. You may not have seen these yet because they're brand new, but let me show you a couple of the features as designed by Bill and show you why this is such an ingenious box. First, you notice that it has a bayonet lid, so it keeps tight, cylinders don't fall out, unlike on these here. Second, once that lid is off, you see that it's padded top and bottom beautifully. You notice that it's held in with a peg. This mimics the old Edison peg boxes from the early 1900s, before he developed the cotton-lined box. He had pegs in his box that held the cylinder firmly in the box, but not touching the edge. Bill has improved upon that. And when you take the cylinder out, part of the design is that you cannot actually scratch the edge of the cylinder. It's designed at just the right length, just the right specifications, so you cannot touch the edge of the cylinder to the edge of the container. And that's huge because, again, human contact is the worst thing that can happen for a cylinder. It's an ingenious device. It allows air to circulate, air to come up through the bottom, even when it's closed. It's a great way to store cylinders. Great to have a lot of cylinders, but even greater to listen to cylinders. And that's what this machine does for us. It allows us to play cylinders to archival standards responsibly without significant damage to the cylinders at all. And it allows us to preserve them digitally. This is the archaeophone. In a vintage phonograph, the mandrel was fixed. But on the archaeophone, it's not fixed, and so you have to actually mount it onto the machine like this. Tighten it down, and there you go. The beauty of a removable mandrel, by the way, is that there are times when you need to play a cylinder backwards, and this will allow you to do that. We don't want to hear it backwards today. We want to hear it in its natural state. And so, there we go. It's on the mandrel. Thanks to the Library of Congress for their use of the Packer campus and the studios here in Culpeper, Virginia.
Just a couple quick last comments about that. Some of the footage that we had to cut for this 8-minute version, David goes into detail about lateral versus vertical. He goes into speed choices, 120, 160, what suggestions you can do. He makes suggestions about stylus choices and so on and so on. There's a wealth of information in this 40 minutes. So those of you that are doing any cylinder transfers, not just using the archaeophone, obviously most people don't have an archaeophone, but there's lots of helpful information in these videos. And it really isn't pie in the sky. These videos will be available very soon. So it's really exciting. And one last thing about for David's, just to thank him, that was not scripted. It's amazing that David just, it flows out of him. His knowledge of cylinders is quite in depth. You can pay me later, that's fine, thank you. But it really is a tribute to his educational and teaching skills that he was able to pull that off. And then, you know, we were able to edit it into those nice videos. Ben Harry did most of the editing for the three main, and my colleague Brian Allen at the library did this montage work, so I want to thank them as well. I know, Will, that we have exceeded our time. I don't know if you want to do any questions or not, but.
Thanks so much for presenting on this extremely important work, and I imagine everybody stayed. We are past 2:30 in case anybody has another obligation, but we, I think, are happy to take questions, too.
In the discussion of quarter-inch tape, I noticed that three-channel 43-mil tracks on quarter-inch was not mentioned in Richard's presentation. I wonder why, because a lot of early stuff was, well, I shouldn't say a lot, but a fair number of early stuff was done that way. For example, the demonstration that Jack Mullen did for the AES in 1953, the chap that did the Los Angeles Philharmonic recordings, a fellow with the Brush Development who recorded the Cleveland Orchestra that way, and the first two George Wright albums recorded at the Richard Vaughan residence were done three-channel, quarter-inch.
That was a casualty of my condensing the 15 minutes down to 8 minutes. It is in there, and it's actually on his whiteboard as he panned by, but I felt that I needed to kind of show representative parts of the video to get an idea of what it was. But it is discussed, and when he holds up his APR 5000 head stack, it has a two-track and a three-track NAB head in it, which he also uses for broadcast cartridges. So that's the other three-track format that's very, it's also 0.43 mil track. So it's, a lot of the NAB cartridges were left, right, and Q were the three tracks. So yes, it is in the video. Thank you.
Could you bring that up?
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring the slide back up that gives the URL for the videos for those of you that really want to take a look at them. So Mark can do that and then you can.
You are not connected. So I have a question. Can we use Packard Campus for our next ARSC video instead of somebody's basement?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure. That didn't sound convincing at all, I didn't think. Other questions? Oops.
Well, big thanks again to our presenters, Jim, Brandon, Marcos, Brad, and Mark. Thank you for coming. I believe it's coffee time again.